This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at REACH 2015, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 19 and 20, 2015.
2 weekends ago, I got the privilege to catch up with a nephew of mine that I hadn't seen for several years. And so we're a bit uninformed with each other. And he got to talking about his work, and he just stated it so rawly. He said raw. He just said, "Merle, I hate my job," and I actually didn't know what all he was doing. I said, "Well, talk about it a little bit." He said, first of all, he said, "I drive 50 minutes to work, and I drive by this wonderful farmland," and he said, "The further I go towards work, the more depressed I get." Well, I said, "Well, where are you ending up at work?" Well, he said, I'm in Michigan, southern Michigan. I travel south to Napanee area, and I work in a trailer factory. He said, "I can't stand it." He said, "I grew up on a farm." And he said, I'm putting on trim in a trailer factory. I don't know how much longer I can do this. Well, I said, "Well, okay, well, why are you doing it?" Well, he says, "It pays so good." And of course, I was curious. You know, I run an organization that has to do with money, and I didn't ask, but sooner or later it came out. He said, I make a little north of 30 an hour. And this is a 25-year-old, but he said, this can't last. Well, the frustration of doing something that does not align is really the heartbeat of this session. And the key verse here that I have for this session is one that's very familiar to us. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all thy might. Very familiar, but very, very, very key. But Marcus Buckingham, in his book, Discover Your Strength, quotes a survey that points to the very point of my story. Of 1.7 million employees in 101 companies said this about their strength and its alignment with their work and its alignment with their strength. Only 20% said that their strengths are engaged on a regular basis. Only 20 out of 1.7 million employees. The background, let me just give you a little bit of background to this session. It really goes back to about 3 years ago when I realized that as a culture, the Anabaptists, the Mennonite, and the Amish have a very powerful work ethic. And if you don't get outside our circles, you may not realize the contrast of our work ethics and others. Recently, at Ag Salt, the company that I'm involved with besides Anabaptist Financial, we had a service technician coming out to help us with our automatic bagger. And he was there while the bagger was running, fine-tuning a few things. And at the end of the day, he said, "Merle, do you realize the competitive advantage you have over your competitor?" And I said, "No, what are you talking about?" He said, "The way your guys are stacking bags on a pallet is incredible compared to Flagship Packaging, which is my competition." He said, "It is night and day." He said, "They are trying to stack salt on a pallet with temp help." And he said, "It's an absolute disaster. You might be paying your guys twice what they are, but they're getting many more times done." As an Anabaptist culture, we have, as it were, a stallion at work, pulling a load with our work ethic, a willingness, a commitment to work. We say work hard. What we don't equally have is a strong understanding and practice of work alignment. And I'm suggesting kind of the heartbeat of this presentation, if we would maintain our work ethic and then get just as good at aligning people in their work and their calling that they're designed and called to do, we would have a pair of horses that would change the world. And so that was 3 years ago. I was in a side conversation with kind of triangling one of the I was in a leadership training session, and the instructor and another student, I was a student as well, was having a conversation about this whole subject of being aligned in your work. And he made just a simple complaint in the form of a question. He said, we had spent the whole day on this thing of work alignment, knowing your strength and the difference it can make as a leader. And he said, where's a tool that is in the language of the Anabaptist culture, the way we talk about work, the way we talk about motivation in work, that I could use with my employees to help have the kind of conversation we had today? Well, before the instructor answered, I knew the answer. I knew he was going to say there isn't anything that exists, because that day we had taken a skills assessment that was from the secular culture out there, and it wasn't anywhere close to the way we talk about motivation. They were using cute little words like the wow factor. Well, what's the wow factor? Well, you know, it was in code, okay? And it wasn't the way we talk about work and motivation and getting the job done. And in that moment, the vision to potentially produce a tool that could help conversation to align people better in work was born. And so behind this talk is there's an assessment tool that I'm developing, it's in its third draft, and it's in Excel at the moment. Some of the people that are here helped build the thing. Dennis, and Michael Petershein did the Excel work for me, but eventually it's got to be webified to really serve the public, and that's probably a year away. So there is no assessment tool to use coming out of this session. What I'm going to do is tell you the brains and the theory behind it, and as it were, sell you on the idea of its potential power, but more than that, to get feedback, to correct and further refine the philosophy behind the tool. No tool is better than its truthfulness about an understanding of people. Okay, so let's jump in and get into the nuts and bolts here. We know that a fully engaged and motivated workforce is the differentiator for exceptional output and organizational performance. More people need to show up at work at the beginning of the day knowing that they are working within their calling and skill and intent on giving 100%, rather than merely putting in time and waiting for the end of the day to head home. People working within their strength produce excellence, innovation, accuracy, profitability, not to mention the hard-to-define zing-zang flow juices that happen when you are aligned, when your work and who you are come together. Organizations that know how to align talent magically, seemingly, or magnetically attract, effectively energize, and irresistibly retain high engaged workers. It's a virtuous cycle that gains momentum and advantage. But for the leaders who are suffering from the vicious backward cycle of bored, misaligned, unengaged workers and organizational lethargy, this flywheel of work engagement looks like a fantasy merry-go-round with no place to get on. I'm suggesting it all starts with a deep understanding and care of people. How you and your organization perceive and understand human nature will determine whether you achieve matching task with talent. It's never easy. People are mysterious, but it doesn't need to feel impossible or endlessly frustrating. Leaders in particular should be adept at understanding people and developing their talent. People need to be harnessed into a work that fits them. We must be highly intentional and yet patient at this work. Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither is a well-aligned workforce. Anxiousness and false urgency doesn't help. We must take our time and start with a Christian view of work that produces purpose, meaning, and wholeness. The only way to find meaningful and purposeful work is to engage the hands and the heart and the head in a manner that utilizes a person's mix of strengths. Your mix of strengths is both physical and spiritual. They are innate, and yet they're shaped through training and experiences. Once a person's elements of motivation are known, full alignment and engagement is rather easy. In the long haul, you cannot will yourself to excel or succeed in any task by merely choosing to do so. But you can do what you're designed to do. Do you know your design, your elements of strength? Peter Drucker, known as kind of the father of modern management, he's dead and gone now, he said it this way: don't try to change yourself. You'll likely not succeed. Obviously, there's some elements of you could take that the wrong way. We are to be transformed daily. But a backdrop, obviously, to a biblical drop back to any understanding of strengths and alignment at work comes from two very familiar passages in Scripture, Romans 12 and 1 Corinthians 12. We're very familiar with them, and I'm not going to be reading much other than just the beginnings a bit of each verse. And I'm slowing down here a bit just because this terrain that we're going to go across is murky. It's dangerous, actually. And this subject is actually popular currently in business literature. This whole thing of plan to your strength and working within your strength is selling books right now. And one of the books I mentioned there by Marcus Buckingham. But we're going to cut across some of the grain. They're saying some very good things, and I'll try to point them out. But we're going to cut across the grain here. And Paul, 2,000 years ago, starts off with his whole subject with warning, not with a whole lot of excitement. He starts with warning. He kind of pulls you back. He jerks you now and saying, "Now be careful, but we're going to talk about some very important things." He jerks us. And here's how he starts both of these passages. If you have your Bibles, 1 Corinthians, let's start with Romans 12. "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, mercies of God, that you present your bodies living sacrifice." These are very familiar verses, "which is in a reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed." Now, this passage, these are very familiar, and we can read the first two verses and then go just about anywhere, and it has application. But Paul is going one place with these verses. While it's fair to take these verses and build a doctrine of nonconformity in various practices, he cares. Where he's going is talking about your strength and giftings. So the context to don't be conformed, in verse 3, he goes on with a little more warning not to think of yourself more highly. Where he's going to end up then in the next paragraph, the next six verses to verse 8, is this whole thing of your gifts. So that's a warning. Don't be conformed. And then let's just go over to 1 Corinthians 12. "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren," he doesn't say, "Let's get excited. This is wonderful." He says, "No, I do not want you to be ignorant." He starts out with a warning. "I do not want you to be ignorant. Be careful here. You need to know the truth about this. And secondly, you know how the Gentiles are carried about by their dumb idols." Where's he going? Don't be ignorant about idols. Well, he's going to spend, this is our largest portion on spiritual gifts. He's going to go on for the whole chapter about spiritual gifts. Now, is there a tie between Romans 12 and Corinthians 12? It's the same author, and I'm suggesting he's talking about the same thing. Let me do a paraphrase for you that I think justifies this. Don't be like the world and worship at the shrine of your gifts and talents. Don't be naive and ignorant and possibly be carried about in arrogance and idolatry because of your spiritual gifts and talents. Don't be conformed. Don't think highly of yourself. Don't be ignorant. This thing of your talents is dangerous. You can go to idolatry by being good at something. Any of you here really good at something? Any temptations in really being good and being the star and being better than the next person? Any chance of straying from Christ? Yeah. Just look around. Be different than the world. Any chance of having an identity about what you can do at work and it cuts you off from Christ? It becomes your sense of identity. Your whole sense of being is wrapped up in your capacity, your skills that you engage at work. Very, very significant warning that I want to kind of voice here and just kind of take pause here. And it's careful how we it's important that we pay attention to the possibility of idolatry and the possibility of arrogance when you actually know your strength and know what you're good at and you do it well. Treasures, talents bring pleasure, and with pleasure can come gratitude and worship or arrogance. You can go very different places with being good at something. Now, Paul's going to launch into, that's the warning, okay? But he really wants to say then, okay, what's this all about? Now, I'm suggesting that Paul talks about four things here. One is one spirit and yet different gifts. Talents and motivational gifts come from one and only one spirit. And again, I think it's through birth and through nurture. This diagram here illustrates the source of our gifts as at the center, the Spirit. It's one Spirit, and yet it expresses itself seven different ways, but it comes from the Spirit. In the same way, Paul says, you can't say Jesus is Lord without the Spirit. You can't have these talents if it weren't for the Spirit. Here's a quote from the book Power of Uniqueness. Because gifting is like breathing, every person has used their giftedness throughout the years, be there many or few. You can't ungift yourself. It's innate. It's in there. The childhood, here's another quote. The childhood shows the man as morning shows the day. Secondly, while there's one spirit, there's different gifts. Spiritual gifts, as described here in Corinthians and Romans, are often understood as a basic orientation or a motivation of service. And we know that there's one list of seven, and some would say, well, maybe it's nine, and there's different ways to understand the gifts. I am going to give you a way to think about this, and that obviously there's controversy of whether it's meant to be this way, and I'll mention a thing or two about that in a bit. But there's two ways of thinking about talent. One is motivation, what's under the surface, and the other is a talent as in a skill that you apply. And I'm going to be talking about it mainly in the sense of motivation. When I built my skill assessment, I wanted it to be in tune with the universe. I wanted it to be in tune with the reality of human nature. And sometimes we force the scriptures to kind of reveal its code in categories that were never intended. This could be true about the way what we do with the seven spiritual gifts. While Paul does provide, you know, seven lists there in Romans 12, I think it's verse the 4 through 6, he doesn't go on to describe what he meant by these words. It's a list. And even though Paul is, I think, is providing seven timeless categories of human giftings, he only provides the key words with no further description. information from the Bible about spiritual gift is much like information about training children. The scriptures provide a few principles and categories to master the all-important thing of raising children, and yet you're going to have to rely on the Spirit for 95% of the choices you've got to make for 20 years while you're raising them. This thing of the seven spiritual gifts is the same way. Don't hear me championing that, though. What I'm going to share here today about them is biblical, and this is the way Paul meant for them to be understood, and here's the definitions to them, and this is biblical, case closed. And well, it's there, okay? But we have to rely on the Spirit here to take these seven, in this case, and do well with it. So we have one Spirit, different gifts. Paul also makes a point about there's one body and many members. The source of the seven comes from one Spirit to empower many to make a complete body. It takes many to make one. Many to make one. So the outer circle of my diagram here is to symbolize the one body encompassing many people. And yet with those many people are the seven demonstrations of the one Spirit. So sometimes we think about that in a global sense of the body of Christ, as many, make up one. And we also think of it locally. And again, sometimes, obviously, we think of that at a church level. But at the work level, I want you to think of it in terms of any team, any group of people that is coming together and working together is the same principle here that apply to church, apply to the work. One Spirit expresses itself seven-dimensionally in many people to produce one body, the body of Christ. The last point Paul makes here is the point of being interdependent upon each other and that there's no schism. Let's talk about that a little bit. We need each other, not only for survival and mutual growth and mutual benefit, but in order to build the kingdom and be productive. Teamwork and collaboration is at the heart of the spiritual gifts. All the gifts need to be yoked together to harness the full strength of the Spirit. The old cliche of opposites attract is so true. In giftings, different gifts depend on each other to create wholeness and strength. Interdependence means linking the parts together to create wholeness, a oneness. I need you is the message that should flow between workers. God's design is for everyone to be part of a oneness body, a one body, interdependent on each other and interdependent on each other to experience the full strength of the Spirit. The Spirit expresses itself by seven dimensions or seven aspects of giftedness. As those seven dimensions are found in a group, a supernatural, you might say, strength occurs. Strength not achieved by merely many pulling together. You can have many pulling together, and not all seven aspects of the Spirit are represented, and you don't have the full strength of the Spirit. We'll come back to that later. As individuals, we have weaknesses. Let's talk about weaknesses a little bit. But as a team, we can achieve a collective strength. Personal weaknesses forces us to counter individualism and relational distance and moves us toward each other, linking each other's strength to our weakness. Paul comments on it this way, I will glory in my weakness that the power of Christ might rest on me. He goes on to say, when I'm weak, then am I strong. Now, what's he really meaning by this? When you have a weakness that is a weakness in relation to not being Christ himself, who would carry all the strengths, okay? He set it up so that you're weak, so that we're connected to our brother. So now when you come to a task and you're not Christ cloned, okay? You represent an aspect. He set it up this way, so we must have each other to actually create the fullness of the Spirit. You come up against a task where you have a weakness. This weakness is not a sin. This is set up so that you don't act like a lone ranger and pull it off without anyone's help. We all experience these weaknesses. If you pray to the Lord that the Spirit would empower your weakness, temporarily take it away so that you could do this test with more excellence, does he hear those prayers? How do you cure your weakness? How do you deal with your weakness? I'm suggesting that Christ doesn't cure our weakness, by some prayer to somehow energize me and enable me and remove that weakness so I can deliver the goods. That would be counter to the whole thing of you needing your brother to deliver a task, to accomplish a mission. Paul's very clear here that it's set up so that weakness requires you. If you're going to solve weakness, if Christ is truly going to be glorified, it's because you respect the brother who's strong where you're weak, and you form a relationship. You pull from him. You don't reach out of heaven and say, Lord, come deliver me from this. No, you start to be connected to people who are strong. And in that way, I think is the genius of this concept of one body to achieve strength. The real truth is the wise person addresses weakness by linking arms with those whose strength complement their weakness. Last thought here is on the thing of no schism. Paul's concern about no schism is not that a group should never divide or split, but that all the parts of the body are equally valued as essential participants to create wholeness. That we respect all aspects of the gifts, all seven. And he's concerned about wholeness here. I think a little bit more, the emphasis is wholeness rather than relational harmony, that we're just getting along. Let's take a look here then at the seven gifts that I'm referring to. You're familiar with them. And I have the biblical words there on one list, and across from that is what I built my assessment tool around. I wanted to find words that fit the language that we talk at work. I wanted the seven motivational gifts are typically understood and applied in the context of ministry and worship atmospheres. And I know of no assessment designed for the workplace that is intentionally built on the seven biblical categories. In fact, the way the seven spiritual gifts have typically been taught as applied to church ministry, I think has contributed to the sacred secular split at work. For example, what do you think a giver looks like when he's on the job? That one in particular, when I actually started this study of what do the gifts look like, what is their motivation at work, this is where I found even my own understanding kind of a gap. Because we particularly picture the giver at the end of the day, at the end of things, being generous and being connected and caring about all you nonprofits, or you hope so. Well, what do you think they act like, and what gets them out of bed in the morning? You think it's because they care so much about your ministry? Well, fortunately, it's just so odd. It's like this process was embarrassing because I'm actually married to a giver. And you'd think I'd just kind of intuitive know what givers do at 6 o'clock in the morning rather than on Monday rather than what they do at church. So my wife, Amy, is a giver, and here's what it looked like just last week. Someone opened the refrigerator door, and lo and behold, one of the children had put an open cup of milk, not even in front, it was on the back, and I think somebody went and pulled out one of the shelves, and this cup tipped off the back and spilled down over the back of the refrigerator. And I'm back in my office, and I hear this ruckus coming from the kitchen. And Amy's saying a few things, and it's like, okay, well, I better go out there and pay attention. I go out there, and she's a bit alarmed about this spilt milk in the back of the refrigerator. Now, you know the cliche, you shouldn't cry over spilt milk. But I'm telling you, a giver cares about spilt milk. Now, not so much that little milk was so valuable, but what about the 30 minutes it's going to take to clean up the refrigerator? Well, my gifting is problem solving. I come alive when things like this happen. It's like I'm built to solve problems. And it's like I come out there and I decided that, well, it's no use calming Amy down. She's gifted to preserve resources, and that's time, that's milk, that's anything. I just jumped in and started, I'll just clean this milk up. I was motivated. But not Amy. It wasn't the cleanup. She didn't have the energy to clean it up. She had the energy to ask the question, who put that milk in the back of the refrigerator on that shelf? This will not happen again under Why Watch. That's the giver at work. My wife hates debt. Why does she hate debt? I'm a risk taker. I'm not happy if there's not some debt on the business. You know, we're leveraging things. But boy, she can cry over this thing of business debt. Why? The risk is up of losing the resources. But I'm Mr. Entrepreneur, and it's like, but with this debt, we potentially could, conquer the world or whatever. See the difference in gifts? Now, you wonder what our marriage looks like. We are so different, my wife and I. But what my point here is that we have, I don't think we've made good enough sense about what these motivational gifts, their impact at the workplace. And that's some of the motivation that pushed me to design an assessment tool. And at the end here, we'll look at that a little bit more. So think of motivators then, these seven motivators, as a description not a description of a specific role, but rather a broad category of a person or an orientation. For example, a person with a lead talent of communicator, or the scripture used teacher, I use the word communicator, is not automatically predisposed to be a teacher at school. Or let's say a diagnostic specialist at the car repair shop is not necessarily motivated or oriented to be a problem solver. An example of this, I took a class on child psychology down at Grove City years back. And I went in class the first day, and you're always curious, about the instructor and all, and what kind of teacher they're going to be. And of course, about 30 of us students there, and I'm the only 40-year-old among all these 20-year-olds, so I was feeling a little, but I was a bit more observant than some of them. And almost late, the professor comes in, walks to the front of the room, and walks across and adjusts the window a little bit, and comes back, opens his book, and starts the semester of class like this. John Adams, here. Sally Smith. Now, this guy's going to talk about child psychology. I was assuming the instructor might have had cuddled a baby in his lifetime and actually be able to tell a story about children. This guy is a teacher. And he graduated from some college, at the top of his class. This guy is the worst teacher I've ever sat under. Now, he's a teacher. His role, his motivation? His motivation is that he's actually gifted and motivated in communication. But he doesn't belong in the classroom. He belongs in some lab research center far away from people. He didn't know anything about real children. Very little. It's all research on just a bunch of facts. I almost failed the class. It's like teacher oriented, but he didn't belong in the classroom. He wasn't aligned at all with his work. But he had the stats. He had the status in the educational system to be a professor, and he was there. Now, the categories here, I want to show you that while these are the seven biblical categories, I did some research to say, do the people that don't read their Bible agree, would they agree with these seven categories? What is the secular world? What is the science of human behavior saying about the motivational categories of people? Well, here is six assessments, five. You see on the right there, there's the biblical row, the seven, prophet, exhorter, mercy teacher, etc. And then you see the skills assessment is what I built. And so there's my words, and they're matched, okay? I'm just trying to find language that we would use to say the same thing. And then some of you would be familiar with the DISC, which is actually four categories. It's more personality related than it is skills, work skills. But it's used widely in the work arena. And so I duplicated some of them. There's four categories, so there's some of them are combined. And then you have, there's an assessment used by Dave Ramsey. And again, his assessment is simply a secular assessment that he branded under his company name. He made very little attempts to, none. His is actually a secular assessment. I found it on other websites, and he just has the Dave Ramsey trademark on it. And interesting enough, take a look at one of his categories. Individualist is a primary motivator of people. You like the category? Individualist. How's that for a secular understanding of people? That fundamentally you are designed and motivated to be alone and be individual and not be connected to the world. But yet there's another one out there that uses individualist as well. Very, very secular. Buckingham in Standout. I don't know if that's his. Marcus Buckingham is probably the strongest writer. He's popularizing this notion right now. He's wrote several books. Now Go Discover Your Strength. His latest one is called Standout. But he's on target. The seven categories match. I don't know if that's interest you. It is to me. I'd like to hear. Sometimes the world does see straight, and sometimes they don't. But not a big vote of confidence. But did some research there, and some of them are saying the same thing. They use different words. My point here with the bus is, I want you to think of the way we're talking about motivation here, kind of as the bottom level of the seats on the bus versus the top level. Top level, I'm thinking of in terms of job skills. Bottom level is more the motivation and the orientation that you bring. Paul talks about both. When he uses the seven, I think the seven are motivational. Okay, so when you think of teacher, don't think teaching in the school. Okay, think orientation. That person may not even belong in the school, okay? And we'll get to what that includes. Okay, let's climb into a little bit. Okay, what do we mean by these seven? And I'm using my words here instead of the... So visionary is what the Bible calls prophet. They're motivated to innovate, envision, discern, rightly judge, establish values, and particularly values as it relates to end goals. Now, I'm going to just, I'll tell you what, we're just going to go real quickly here, rather than, I was going to illustrate them, but boy, we're running out of time here. An organizer is motivated to administrate, delegate, organize, coordinate, implementer, motivated to perform tasks, achieve, systematize, be conscientious. The steward is motivated to establish lists, goals, strategize, mobilize, protect resources. The communicator or the teacher is motivated to analyze, reason, reflect, understand, communicate, help others learn. And the relator is motivated to be authentic, inclusive, to love, trust, encourage, challenge others. Problem solver or mercy, motivated to solve problems, remove barriers, eliminate waste, listen, empathize, and restore. Now, it'd be helpful to take the time to point out a few people that kind of, it's their leading gift. I don't have time for that. But I want to illustrate it in this way, and that is a visionary, for example, will say, hey, I have a vision. We can accomplish this. There's a mission out here that if we get it fulfilled, the end results would be wonderful. The organizer comes along and says, well, I can help. And I can help bring some planning and organization to completing this mission. The implementer says, well, I actually can run the plan. I can actually make things happen. Count on me to follow through to even get the plan accomplished. The communicator tends to say, well, I'll do the research. I'll help analyze whether this mission can even be completed. I'll do the counting. I'll handle the information. The steward says, wait, not so fast, everybody. Slow down. But I'll help secure the resources that are needed to ensure that we can actually complete the mission. Problem solver is all excited. He said, let's go. If we hit the wall, I'll help fix it. I'll help repair. I'll help deal with the chaos. And the relator says, or the exhorter says, well, I'll make sure we all get along. I'll make sure that we have a culture of trust, we respect each other. You see the completeness of all seven. Pull any one of them out, and you don't have a team. Now, one of the things that is very important here about spiritual gifts, and one of the ways it's been ruined, is that we've tended to stereotype the spiritual gifts in thinking that one spiritual gift characterizes me. Okay? And let me suggest that that is stereotyping the spiritual gifts. You are more diverse than one gift. And it only gives you seven categories to understand people who are way more complex. I'm suggesting that we think of motivation as like your two legs, that yes, when you go, you lead off with a leg, but the second one is right there. Think of yourself in terms of your core motivation as your two lead gifts. For example, if you're visionary, like Joel is, Joel Martin from All Nations is motivated visionary. But a vision person who has problem solving as their second leg that follows the first one will tend to be a high-risk visionary. Because he's saying, let's go get it, and you know what? If we hit the wall, it'll be fine, we can fix it. Versus the visionary, a person whose second gift is steward, is going to approach vision very differently, very cautiously, compared to the vision problem solver combination. See the difference? So the vision problem solver is careless with vision. They get all about excited about things, and they haven't thought about half what they need to. Versus the vision steward is going to be that he's going to have vision, but he's going to go much slower, and he's going to look around for all, he's going to tend to look for other people to help make sure we can actually meet it without, meet the goal, meet the vision without killing ourselves. Thanks. We need to think of our top two gifts and the synergy between the two. When you do it that way, you have 42 categories versus seven to understand people and to nuance motivation. Okay, so I'm suggesting in the center here that there's all, you should think of motivation in a dual sense. And we're not gonna have time here, there's five categories, five ways to think about motivation then in terms of will and commitment, need and purpose, love and passion, relational context, and skills and excellence. And boy, there's a lot to be said here. I'm going to, though, skip here and finish with a thought. Wow, I got a lot of information I'm not covering here. Let me go to here, 5 minutes or less. Team, I want us to think about something here, and that is when we put teams together to accomplish a task, we're very good at understanding that all the seats on the bus, as it were, need to be filled to get a task done. So you can't run an organization or a company without a president, and then you need the secretary, and you need accounting, and you need operations. We're very adept at the level of skill. We have not paid attention to having all the seats on the bus filled from the standpoint of motivation. Okay, you follow the question here? Paul's concerned about that all seven gifts of the Spirit are present in a team to create wholeness. Okay, now think motivation. Think motivation here. Don't necessarily think of skill or job skill. Think of motivation. What happens when you have all the upper seats on the bus full, everyone's agreed to their job description, but when they sit at the bottom of the bus in motivation, they're all visionaries? What's going to happen to that organization? Or let's say they're all stewards. Though they have the skill, they have the skill to do these diverse things operationally, but motivationally, only one or two or three of the seven gifts of the Spirit, the seats are occupied. This is what Paul is concerned about when he says, you can't say that I don't need the foot just because I'm the arm, or the eye can't say to the ear. When's the last time your organization, when they were hiring, asked the question, motivationally, do we have the fullness of the Spirit represented? Or is the question, boy, we have this accounting option, and boy, we need somebody good with numbers, and we don't want them careless here, and do they got a little experience, or do they have their degree? But are we asking the question, what motivational gift is missing in our organization? I'm suggesting that question is not coming up. The seats on the bottom of the bus might be all loaded to one side. Matter of fact, the whole thing of birds of a feather flock together can kill your organization. You know, you like to hang out with a visionary. Joel and I, you get us together, we're a dangerous group. It's good Joel and I aren't the same organization. Okay? But we like people oriented just like us. No fights, but y'all hit the wall and burn, of course. You know, there's no struggle because y'all kind of orient. Y'all care about the same thing. We're going to accomplish this big move. It's important that we pay attention to your motivation and that we create teams, nonprofits, for-profits, and we ask this question. This is our secret that the world is not even asking either. Okay, but this takes work to climb below the surface. Oh, you're good at accounting? You know, hired. Your motivation, whew. That's a harder question. If we're gonna align people, we've got to know their motivation, not just their skill. This is my passion in relation to the skill assessment. And I just want to show you the skill assessment. We've got 1 minute left here. Of course, it's not available, but I'm just wanting to show you what I'm hoping this can do for our people. First of all, it asked you 175 statements. It has 175 statements that you score yourself on. Those statements are going to, in the end, produce 35 skills that you or someone else rates you on. And in your handout there, you can see the 35 skills and the meaning of those words. Those 35 skills then translate to the seven categories. But we'll get to that in a minute. So 35 skills, and you find out from your own perspective and from others. You can use it, you can do a 360 degree, and you score yourself. I'm hoping that becomes a very good discussion where we learn, we drill down into the seven spiritual gifts, because each of the seven has five of these skills that it's married to. Okay, so you can look at it two ways. You can look at it categorically, seven, or you can look at it 35, which has five expressions to each of the seven, make 35. Okay, you follow that? You can drill down to the seven and tear one of them apart, and there's five skills that express the one spiritual gift like organizer. what I'm hoping by an assessment like this is that is that it leads to discussion and insight. A skill assessment doesn't have much power when you're alone in your closet looking at the results. It only has power as you bring this to your brother and say, is this true about me? Is this really my strengths? And you put stories to it, and here's why the skill of discerner is so you. And you tell stories that actually color that word, and you put your unique spin on it. It's really the discussion around it that brings the information and the insight. I'm not gung-ho on tools that are cold and calculated, and you've got to, in community, discern the truth and color it according to who the person really is. Well, our time's up, and wow, we missed a big section there. As you can tell, my gift is not being highly organized. I didn't time my slides, so there's my weakness. But thanks for your attention. Our time is up.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.